From Washington, this is VOA's International Edition. Coming up, pro-democracy protests continuing in Hong Kong, Indian economic growth on the agenda here in Washington, containing the Ebola outbreak, plus Kurds battling Islamic State insurgents. Hello, everyone. I'm Steve Norman. Thousands of Hong Kong residents have camped out on some of the city's biggest streets for a second night in an unprecedented protest against what they see as unfair election rules imposed by Beijing. Many of the protesters set up barricades on streets around the main government complex in other districts late Monday and early Tuesday, but there was no repeat of chaotic scenes from the previous night when riot police fired tear gas and pepper spray to try to disperse the demonstrators. The mood among the protesters was festive as they chanted slogans calling on the city's Beijing-backed leader, Chief Executive Leung Chun-ying, to resign. The demonstrators accuse Chun-ying of failing to communicate to Beijing their desire for a genuine choice of candidates in the city's next chief executive election in 2017. That's when the Chinese government has said Hong Kong voters can vote for their leader in a system of universal suffrage for the first time. Last month, China's communist ruler said the only candidates who can run for the leadership post must be approved by a majority of the 1,200-member committee of mostly Beijing loyalists. Here is what one protester, a Chinese university student, had to say about the ruling.
We have a simple message, is that we just want democracy and a fair voting of choosing our chief executive of Hong Kong. Just simple and nothing more.
At least 40 people have been injured since the protests began over the weekend. Most of the demonstrators have been peaceful, but Hong Kong's assistant police chief accused them of engaging in violence.
We strongly condemn the violent acts of some protesters who charged the police court in line, leading to the injuries of not only police officers, but other people in the public order events. We now appeal to those who still occupy the road in Hong Kong Island and some park in Kowloon West, i.e. Mong Kok, and leave the area as soon as possible so that the situation could be brought under control.
And here in Washington, White House spokesman Josh Earnest called on Hong Kong authorities to exercise restraint and said protesters should express their views peacefully. He also said this about the political dispute over Hong Kong's election system.
We believe that the basic legitimacy of the chief executive in Hong Kong will be greatly enhanced if the basic law's ultimate aim of selection of the chief executive by universal suffrage is fulfilled. We also believe that the legitimacy of the chief executive will be enhanced if the election provides the people of Hong Kong a genuine choice of candidates that are representative of the people's and the voters' will.
And in Beijing, a foreign ministry spokeswoman said China is resolutely opposed to any illegal activities that threaten Hong Kong's rule of law and social stability. She also warned foreign governments against supporting the protest. Also in the news, India's Prime Minister Narendra Modi is here in Washington, where he had an initial meeting on Monday before a private dinner at the White House tonight, both of those with President Obama. And later today, Mr. Modi will take part in bilateral discussions at the White House called an effort to expand and deepen the U.S.-India strategic partnership. We get more now from VOA's Victor Beatty.
Obama administration officials have called the bilateral relationship a defining partnership of the 21st century. The United States has expressed support for Mr. Modi's economic reforms and will offer assistance in counterterrorism and energy security. The Indian Prime Minister is also expected to meet corporate leaders from companies like Google, IBM, General Electric, Goldman Sachs, and Boeing in a bid to lure foreign investment. RAND Corporation India analyst Rafiq Dosani says Mr. Modi's message to them is simple. India is open for business.
That the red tape that historically almost defines doing business in India is a thing of the past. There are things here which he's promising and which he's yet to deliver on, but his intent is to deliver a strong message that things will change.
IHS Global Chief Economist Rajiv Biswas also says India is looking to the United States to help New Delhi modernize its armed forces and develop its domestic defense industry.
For Prime Minister Modi, the key priorities during his visit to the U.S. are the economic aspects, to build up the trade and investment relationship, to persuade U.S. multinationals that India's on the rise again, the economy is on the mend, and that he's going to be much more dynamic than the previous government in dealing with approvals for new investments, and also to strengthen the defense cooperation with a number of major negotiations now very well advanced, particularly for a deal of $2.5 billion for the Indian military purchase of Apache and Chinook helicopters, but also other major deals are under negotiation as well.
Biswas says India represents one of the world's fastest-growing consumer markets, with total consumer spending forecast to rise from $1.1 trillion last year to $4.3 trillion by 2023. Bilateral trade reached $63.7 billion in 2013, slightly below what India traded with China. But Biswas says when trade and services is factored in, the U.S.-India trade relationship actually totaled about $94 billion last year. Sunday, Mr. Modi received an enthusiastic welcome from thousands of Indian Americans who filled New York's famed Madison Square Garden.
America, dunya ka sabse purana loktantra hai.
Mr. Modi said America is the oldest democracy in the world. India is the biggest democracy in the world, he said. The entire world has come and settled down in India, and the people of India have gone and settled down in the entire world. One of those in attendance, Sunny Khurana, called the Prime Minister a new type of leader.
He spoke like a world leader. That's been lacking in mostly all of India's leadership in the past. We've had politicians, but no genuine world leader. One-sixth of humanity definitely deserves a person who can talk and kind of get a whole movement started. And he's the man. He's the man for the job.
The RAND Corporation's Rafiq Dosani says Mr. Modi's trip is personally important to burnish his world standing in light of the controversy surrounding the revocation of his U.S. visa in 2005 in the wake of sectarian violence in Gujarat state during his tenure as chief minister. Dosani says if he can create a good impression in America, it improves his standing elsewhere, thus making this more important than his visits to Japan and China. Victor Beatty, VOA News, Washington.
And still ahead, the latest on the Sunni insurgency in Syria and Iraq.
From the ordinary to the extraordinary, you never know what in the world will happen next.
The world is watching with grave concern as Russia has positioned its
military. You should not allow anyone to deprive you of your right to determine the future.
We are using this against terrorist groups coming from Turkey.
With a landing on
and
civilians.
Sponsored by, no, we are not killing civilians.
With all that's happening, VOA News works to keep you up to date every hour of every day. So when you want to know what's new, you know what to do. Tune in your radio or click on the internet. World News on the hour, every hour, or at your convenience at voanews.com.
Kurdish militias in northern Syria continue to clash with Islamic State militants on Monday. Coalition forces capped off their first week of airstrikes with fresh attacks on militant positions in Syria and Iraq. U.S. Central Command said Jordan and the United Arab Emirates participated in the most recent coalition strikes in Syria. Joint forces hit Islamic State vehicles, weapons, and compounds in several parts of the country. But coalition strikes did not reach the Kurdish town of Kobani near the Turkish border, where fighting has created an exodus of Syrian Kurds and prompted Turkey to strengthen its military presence on the border.
The
leader of Al-Qaeda's Syria affiliate has vowed his group will use all possible means to fight against airstrikes by the U.S.-led coalition. In a 25-minute audio recording, al-Nusra front leader Abu Muhammad al-Ghulani portrayed the U.S.-led invasion as a crusader alliance against Sunni Muslims and vowed to fight back. The recording appeared genuine and corresponded with Associated Press reporting. The U.S. views the affiliate known as the Nusra Front as a terrorist group, but Syrian rebels have long seen it as a potent ally against both the Islamic State extremist group, which is the main target of the coalition, and Syrian President Bashar al-Assad's forces. Syrian rebels, activists, and analysts have warned that targeting the Nusra Front will inject more chaos into the Syrian conflict and indirectly help Mr. Assad by striking one of his main adversaries. The U.S. insists it wants Mr. Assad to step down, but it's not targeting his forces, which are best placed to benefit from the airstrikes. Israel's prime minister is urging the international community not to allow Iran to develop nuclear capabilities and tie the Jewish state's fight against Hamas militants in the Gaza Strip to the larger global fight against Islamic State militants. From the UN, VOA's Margaret Bashir reports the Syrian foreign minister also addressed the UN General Assembly on Monday on the fight against terror.
Israeli leader Benjamin Netanyahu said militant Islam is on the march all over the world. He warned that groups such as Islamic State seek global domination. He criticized countries who have supported U.S.-led efforts to crush ISIS, as the group is also known, for not supporting Israel in its own recent 50-day war against Hamas militants, who indiscriminately fire rockets into Israel from Gaza.
They evidently don't understand that ISIS and Hamas are branches of the same poisonous tree. ISIS and Hamas share a fanatical creed, which they both seek to impose well beyond the territory under their control.
Mr. Netanyahu also urged the international community not to sign a nuclear deal with Iran, allowing it to continue enriching some uranium.
Make no mistake, ISIS must be defeated. But to defeat ISIS and leave Iran as a threshold nuclear power is to win the battle and lose the war.
He warned that once Iran has the capacity to produce nuclear bombs, all the charms and smiles of the Iranian leadership will quickly disappear. Mr. Netanyahu said there is only one course of action, and that is to fully dismantle Iran's nuclear military capabilities. Syria's foreign minister also spoke Monday. Walid Mualim said Islamic State is the most dangerous terrorist organization in the world in terms of funding and brutality. He urged that pressure be exerted on countries who have joined the U.S.-led coalition against Islamic State militants to end their support of armed groups. Damascus has repeatedly accused Gulf Arab states of supporting the armed opposition in Syria, which the regime characterizes as terrorists. Mualim, speaking here through a translator, did not appear to criticize targeted U.S.-led airstrikes in Syria.
Once again, the Syrian Arab Republic reiterates that it stands with any international effort aimed at fighting and combating terrorism.
Peace talks in Geneva between the regime and opposition representatives broke down earlier this year. Minister Mualim said the Assad government wants a political solution and is working with a real opposition, but did not indicate when or how talks might resume. Last year, the minister's speech was delivered weeks after hundreds of civilians were killed in a chemical attack in the city of Ghouta that the West blamed on Syria's government. Since then, the government has given up its chemical arsenal under the orders of the UN Security Council, an achievement that Minister Mualim underscored to the Assembly. Margaret Bashir, VOA News, the United Nations.
And addressing the United Nations General Assembly on Monday also was the Vatican Secretary of State, Cardinal Pietro Parolin. He said only way to deal with the security challenge posed by the Islamic State group is through a worldwide effort to stop them.
With the dramatic situation in northern Iraq and some parts of Syria, we are seeing a totally new phenomenon, the existence of a terrorist organization which threatens all states, vowing to dissolve them and to replace them with a pseudo-religious world government.
Cardinal Parolin said the violent acts committed by the militants in Iraq and Syria are born out of disregard for God.
The global nature of this phenomenon, which knows no border, is precisely why the framework of international law offers the only viable way of dealing with this urgent challenge. This reality requires a renewed United Nations that undertakes to foster and preserve peace.
Colonel Paroline also said the international community must look into the root causes behind the militants' acts of aggression and why disillusioned young people are readily joining their causes. The Holy See is not a member of the United Nations, but has a permanent observer status.
VOA Special English, a way to learn American English and much more. Broadcasting a half hour of world news and features every day on radio. You can also find Special English on television and online at voaspecialenglish.com. For 50 years, helping people understand world events and the language and culture of America.
The United Nations has opened the headquarters of its new mission to combat Ebola, assembling a team in Ghana to coordinate the international response. It is the first time the United Nations has set up such an emergency health mission. UN Secretary General Ban Ki-moon says they will help to unify the response to the Ebola outbreak, coordinating international aid and providing support to affected countries. Meantime, on Monday, France said it will help Guinea in its fight against Ebola. French President François Hollande made the pledge to help Guinea during a visit by President Alpha Condé.
J'ai décidé, c'était lors de la conférence de presse que j'ai faite.
He said France will install a field hospital, which will be a third center for medical treatment in Guinea's outback. He also said 25 French doctors will go there to work to consolidate Guinea's healthcare system. And a new Ebola treatment center operated by the International Red Cross released its first survivors this past weekend, that near Kanema in eastern Sierra Leone. It is one of the areas hardest hit by Ebola, and the Ministry of Health recording 423 cases there. Nina DeVries spoke to the survivors, family, and friends about their ordeal.
When Kadiatu Bangura saw her brother Emmanuel for the first time after her release from the Ebola treatment center, she ran into his arms crying tears of joy. She had not seen him for weeks and was not sure she would ever see him again.
I'd be afraid. The one don't be like that white.
Bangura, just 11 years old, says she was afraid of the health workers when they first approached her as they were dressed all in white and she could not see their faces. She says she now knows that they had to dress like that to protect themselves from contracting this deadly disease. Emmanuel Bangura says he called the emergency number 117 as soon as he realized Kadiatu was having the symptoms of Ebola, which include diarrhea and vomiting. He's glad he caught the disease in time so she could get treatment early.
Yeah, I feel happy and I appreciate God having my sister back because I understand that this sick is a deadly sick.
In a nearby village in the Waterloo district, about an hour from the capital, Freetown, Osman Sese holds up his certificate of discharge from the Red Cross facility.
I feel fine. Then give me food.
Sese explains he feels okay now and is happy to be home. And although these two survivors have beaten Ebola, they may still face challenges, explains Gandhi Kalon, who works with the Ministry of Health and Sanitation.
A survivor coming back into the community, we pose a very big challenge. Stigmatization has been a major problem. In fact, it has only been a major problem for survivors. It's also a major problem for those affected with the sickness to come forward and actually go to the hospitals so that immediate remedial actions can be taken.
The Ministry of Health and Sanitation and the Red Cross in Freetown are working together to help stop the stigma. Red Cross spokesperson Patrick Masakoi says that means working first with those who survive Ebola.
They go through a lot of counseling at the treatment center. Then they are being accompanied by a social worker who bring them into the community. Then the beauty about the Red Cross, we are right across in all the districts. So the local Red Cross that is in that particular district is charged with the responsibility in order to go to the community and meet the family members, political and traditional authorities, and the security for them to receive the survivors into their community.
If you go to the hospital quick, the Kimena, the Iwen.
Red Cross staff members also give talks to the community where survivors live to explain Ebola prevention measures, how to detect it, and that early treatment will increase chances of survival. They explain why survivors should not be feared. And for John Andrews in Osman Sese's community of Banga Ground, he is listening.
Now we're happy now to see our brother back. He's totally healed.
As for Kadiatu Bangura, she says one of the first things she will do is talk to her community about Ebola prevention too, so that no one else gets sick. She hopes they will listen. Nita DeVries for VOA News, Freetown, Sierra Leone.
World Health Organization says the total number of Ebola infections could reach 20,000 by November, months earlier than previously forecast. U.S. Center for Disease Control and Prevention also warning that between 550,000 and 1.4 million people might be infected in the region by January if nothing is done. Meantime, a French volunteer working for Doctors Without Borders in Liberia has contracted Ebola, adding that seven local staff members have already fallen ill from the deadly virus. Healthcare workers account for hundreds of the infected in the outbreak that have already killed more than 3,000 people and infected thousands more across Guinea, Liberia, Nigeria, and Sierra Leone. There is a new report from the International Organization for Migration. It finds that 40,000 migrants fleeing war, persecution, and poverty have died since 2000 in dangerous journeys across both land and sea. 200-page report called Fatal Journeys, Tracking Lives Lost During Migration is the world's most comprehensive tally to date of migrant fatalities. Lisa Schlein reporting now for VOA from Geneva.
The report finds Europe is the world's most dangerous destination for irregular migration. The International Organization for Migration reports more than 22,000 migrants since 2000 have lost their lives on treacherous routes across the Mediterranean Sea. And the region has set a record in 2014 for lives lost. The IOM reports more than 3,000 migrants have died trying this year to cross the Mediterranean Sea in flimsy smugglers' boats. This accounts for 75% of the more than 4,000 migrant deaths registered worldwide so far this year. The agency attributes the surge in deaths on growing conflict in the Middle East and chaos across North Africa and West Africa. IOM spokesman Joel Millman says the market is sensitive to external forces, and smugglers take advantage of that by inducing vulnerable migrants to put their lives in their hands.
These smuggling organizations obviously respond to deep changes in the security situation of the sender countries. When Syria got even worse this year with the ISIS taking over parts of the country, that's when you started seeing a lot more Syrians on these boats. And in the 51-day conflict with Gaza, when the ceasefire finally came, that's when you started seeing a lot of Palestinians coming. And the breakdown of authority in Libya created an opportunity.
Millman says the going rate for a voyage across the Mediterranean Sea is between $2,000 and $4,000 a person.
We hear things like $500,000 voyages where organizations can expect that kind of profit from moving several hundred migrants across a very short voyage.
This is the amount IOM estimates smugglers made from the ship they deliberately rammed off the coast of Malta earlier this month, killing an estimated 500 migrants, including 100 children. Only 11 people are known to have survived this deadly shipwreck, which was carrying Syrian, Palestinian, Egyptian, and Sudanese migrants. Since 2000, IOM records show nearly 6,000 migrant deaths have occurred along the U.S.-Mexico border, and another 3,000 deaths from such diverse migration routes as Africa's Sahara Desert and the waters of the Indian Ocean. The agency says the true number of fatalities worldwide is likely to be much higher than the data shows. It says some experts believe for every dead body discovered, there are at least two others never recovered. The International Organization for Migration is calling for an end to what it calls an epidemic of crime and victimization by smugglers and traffickers who prey on desperate, vulnerable people. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
One last item, Spain's constitutional court suspending Catalonia's planned referendum set for November the 9th. It acted on a request from the Spanish central government in Madrid, the court acting hours after Prime Minister Mariano Rajoy said the referendum decree represents a grave attack on the rights of all Spaniards. Under Spain's 1979 constitution, Rajoy said, all Spaniards must vote on issues of sovereignty, not just the 5 million Catalans. Catalonia, which accounts for about a fifth of Spain's economy, has its own language and distinct culture and has long fought for greater autonomy. Many thanks, everyone, for joining us here on The Voice of America for International Edition. For our director, Tracy Carter, and engineers, Zahrat Abuzed and Jim Harmon, I'm Steve Norman in Washington. We hope you have a great Tuesday.
This is Today in History. On September 30th, 420, historian and theologian Jerome died. He is best known for his translation of the Bible into Latin, which is known as the Vulgate version. In 1888, a serial killer known as Jack the Ripper killed his third and fourth victims. The murders took place in impoverished areas in or near London's Whitechapel district. The identity of the Ripper, whose name stemmed from his gruesome mutilation of the victims, is not known. On this day in 1931, the Afrikaner youth movement known as Die Voortrekkers began in South Africa. In 1938, in an effort to appease German dictator Adolf Hitler, Britain, France, Germany, and Italy signed the Munich Agreement. It allowed Germany to occupy the Sudetenland region of Czechoslovakia. Hopes that this concession to the Nazis would satisfy their desire for territory were dashed the following year when the German army took over the rest of Czech territory and invaded Poland. In 1955, American actor James Dean was killed in an auto accident. The 24-year-old Dean, who starred in the 1955 movie Rebel Without a Cause, became a cultural icon for his portrayal of a disaffected teenager. In 1962, Mexican-American labor leader Cesar Chavez founded the National Farm Workers Association, later the United Farm Workers. Also in 1962, black student James Meredith entered the University of Mississippi, defying the practice of racial segregation in the state. In 2005, drawings of Muhammad were printed in a Danish newspaper. The Muslim world reacted in anger with mass demonstrations and riots. More than 200 people were killed in the violence. I'm Dave DeForest with VOA's Today in History.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
The United States is deeply concerned over the sentencing of Chinese ethnic Uyghur professor Ilham Toti to life in prison. He was convicted of separatism in what many considered to be a politically motivated trial. Mr. Toti and several of his students were taken into custody on January 15th and transferred to Xinjiang, an autonomous region home to 10 million Uyghurs. Mr. Toti's trial and severe sentence appear to be part of a disturbing pattern of arrests and trials of public interest lawyers, internet activists, journalists, religious leaders, and others who peacefully express their views or challenge official Chinese policies and actions. As an economics professor at Beijing's Minzu University, Toti created a website to promote understanding between Uyghurs and Han Chinese, which Beijing authorities shut down in 2008. Mr. Toti's trial and sentencing have silenced an important moderate Uyghur voice that peacefully promoted harmony and understanding among China's ethnic groups, particularly Uyghurs. It is critical for Chinese authorities to differentiate between peaceful dissent and violent extremism. The United States has repeatedly expressed its deep concern about China's attempts to silence dissent and tighten controls over Tibetans and Uyghurs. Policies ostensibly designed to maintain stability are counterproductive when they deny Chinese citizens their universal rights and fundamental freedoms. Mr. Toti's 20-year-old daughter, Juher Ilham, is studying at a university in the United States. She said she will continue to fight for her father's release. "He wanted me to stay in a land that had freedom," she said. "I'm speaking out for him. I won't stop." And neither will the United States.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government. If you have a comment, please write to Editorials, VOA, Washington, D.C., 20237, USA. You may also comment and view all our current editorials at the VOA Editorials homepage, www.voanews.com/editorials.